Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind. Until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
This show contains violent content and scenes of domestic abuse. In a small town outside Birmingham, Alabama, sits a plot of overgrown land. It's almost invisible from the road, tucked deep into the forest. Vines snake across the ground, wrapping around trees beside an old, broken-down trailer. A dark history lies beneath those vines. 40 years ago, a woman shot and killed her abusive husband on this land. And now, that woman's grandson will die in exactly the same way. So let's go back. Back to the first time tragedy hit this land. It was 1977, and a woman named Kathleen Mitchell, also known as Mama Cat, drove down the driveway of that property. Her husband was waiting for her, drunk and angry. Her daughter, Sheila, tells me the story.
Before she could even get out of the car, he'd already broken out her windshield. And he was throwing things at her and all kinds of stuff like that. So she ran into the house. And that was when he grabbed her by the neck and started choking her.
He was choking her, and it was just the two of them there. Mama Cat knew she had to do something.
My mom always carried a gun. And she was able to get it out of her purse and shoot him and kill him.
Mama Cat worked with all men at a local plant, and she worked the night shift. Her brothers had taught her how to shoot, and that day it saved her life.
It almost killed her because she had to do that. She went through a really hard time over doing that, but she didn't have any choice.
As Sheila tells me the story about her mom over the phone, all I can think about is another woman, Devin, Devin Gray. Because decades later, Devin's boyfriend, John Vance, Mama Cat's grandson, brought her to that same property. And Devin had no idea what she was getting herself into. Well, what John was getting them into.
I remember it just being covered in blood after everything happened. I had blood splatter all over me.
On the early morning of December 12th, 2017, 40 years after Mama Cat killed her husband, all hell broke loose on that same property. Devin says that John beat her for hours. He was drunk, and the similarities to his grandma's story are uncanny. Devin tells me about what she experienced that night.
I had blood all running down my neck. My lips were swollen. I had bruises all over me.
This wasn't the first time John hit Devin, but she says John looked different that night, that he had an aura of pure evil, a look in his eyes she had never seen before.
He kind of reminded me of the Hulk, like the way he was just like angry and big and had no shirt on and these big muscles and he was just scary.
Just like Mama Cat, Devin says it was either her or him that night, that she had to make a choice.
911, where is your emergency?
I live in Clara. Me and my boyfriend were just fighting, and I just shot him,
I think he's dead.
You shot him?
This is Blind Plea, a show about Devin Gray, the trauma we inherit, and who has the right to defend themselves in America. I'm your host, Liz Flock. In some ways, it seems Devin's fate was already sealed when she arrived in Calera, Alabama. Because when she set foot on the Vance family property in that small town outside Birmingham, she became the latest in a line of women who had come before her, who had been beaten, broken down, and manipulated on that same land, and who survived by any means necessary. That land served as a pressure cooker, with its culture of silence, a history of alcoholism and abuse, and decades of deep isolation. It all came to a head in 2017 and led Devin to where she is now.
Thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Hi, Liz.
Devin, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Oh my God, you're 30.
I know.
Prison is not the ideal place to celebrate a birthday, but this year Devin says it was pretty special. The other women in the facility showered her with a birthday banner, cards, and gifts for her big 3-0.
They said really beautiful things about me, and so it made me feel good to know, you know, that even in places like this, like, you can still find good people and people can see that you're not a bad person.
This is Devin's fifth birthday behind bars. She talks to me from her bunk bed on a prison-issued tablet. That's why it's sometimes hard to hear her. We chat a lot this way, regularly enough that Devin even named the automated voice on the prison phone calls.
Thank you for using Securus.
We call her Martha.
Martha's about to come on, so I will tell you the good stuff in a minute.
You have 1 minute left.
Yeah, see, I knew she was about to come on, so I'll call you back and I'll tell you the good stuff. Okay.
I'm a journalist who covers women who are wrapped up in the criminal legal system, often women who are claiming self-defense. I have been in an abusive relationship myself, so I understand how someone can end up there, in a place they never expected to be. I met Devin by phone 2.5 years ago, when a lawyer in Alabama connected us.
Hey. Hi, I'm Liz. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, no problem.
One of the first things I noticed about Devin is she's resilient. She's going to trade school inside prison for auto servicing because she wants to be a diesel mechanic when she gets out. That way, she'll be able to support herself and her daughter. She's determined like that, but also sensitive. A hopeless romantic. She likes listening to songs from Kacey Musgraves and Mary J. Blige, the ones that make you cry. It's a way for her to process her feelings, and she's always writing in her journal about being in love.
I hate that I'm like this, but I am so in love with love. Like, I am a lover, and I hate it. It's disgusting. But I guess it's just, like, the hope, I guess because I've been so deprived of it, that it's, like, the thing I want the most, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
You know?
Devin says she never got the affection she needed from her parents. So when it comes to romantic love, she falls hard and fast. That's how it was with her and John at first. She told me when she first ran away with him, back when she was 19, she had hit rock bottom. She had been kicked out of college because she was drinking too much. Her mom struggled with alcohol and set a bad example that Devin just couldn't shake. John was her neighbor. He was confident, and she liked that.
He was really charismatic, like, you know, and, you know, everyone always wanted him around. You know, he was always they always wanted him at the party.
John was 25, 6 years older than Devin. They bonded over their difficult childhoods, and they talked about everything. Devin was sweet, and John was tough. When Devin felt mixed up about what to do with her life, John always had a plan.
So how'd you guys get down to Alabama? I know he's
originally from there.
It was a hot and sticky afternoon in July 2013 in upstate New York. John was on the run and Devin was with him. John had pissed some people off, again, which Devin knew. But she didn't know the whole story.
Like, I didn't really understand that he burned so many bridges with his actions and his anger issues and his violence.
John and Devin had already been together for a couple years. During that time, she says she'd learned that John could go from 0 to 60. That he could get scary and violent in an instant. Not only with her, but with other people, even strangers. They had been living with John's sister, but she kicked them out after John got into a drunken argument with some people down the street and fired a semi-automatic rifle into the air. The cops came to his sister's house, and she told John and Devin they had to go. John had an idea for where they could head next.
It was pretty much like, we have nowhere else to go. I have family in Alabama. Do you want to come with me? And at first I thought he was kidding, and I thought it was a joke, and I was just over it. Like, I was like, okay, this is not funny. And he's like, I'm not kidding, you know? And so I was just like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah.
Devin says John promised her that in Alabama, he'd build her her dream home, that it would be a fresh start from his anger issues and run-ins with the law. John was proposing they go to his childhood home in Calera, to the property where his grandmother, Mama Cat, killed her husband, though Devin didn't know that yet. All she knew was that John had lived on the property when he was a kid until the age of 6, when his parents divorced. His mom said his dad became severely abusive, and she fled the property in the middle of the night with John and his older sister in tow. So at this point, John hadn't seen his dad, Henry, in over 20 years. He hadn't been back to that property since they left. And Devin didn't know if Henry would welcome her. She's Black, and John and his family are white. And it's the South.
I didn't know how he was going to treat me. I didn't know if I was going to be accepted. So I was just really worried, like, hey, like, don't forget to tell them, like, I'm a Black girl, you know what I mean?
But Henry said, sure, come on down. And just like that, they were off to Alabama on a Greyhound bus. They had only a few bags with them, and they left behind everything and everyone Devin knew. The bus ride started off okay. John got Devin her favorite sour cream and cheddar chips and a Dr. Pepper for the ride. They watched a Melissa McCarthy movie, The Heat, together on their laptop. John was comforting along the way, checking in on Devin, asking her if she was doing all right. But the ride was 32 hours long, and the closer they got to Alabama, the more distant John became. He got moody and quiet.
It was the longest bus ride ever. It was so long. It was horrible. And I just remember going through all this pain and just being so, like, the further away I got from home, the more scared I was, because it was just like, what am I doing? I don't. This is not a good idea. This is not smart, you know?
But she kept those fears to herself.
Would lie his way into their dreams.
He was looking for James Bond girls.
How fun would that be to be a Bond girl?
Then twist them into a nightmare.
This guy's done this before. He'll do it again.
Until a group of women banded together to put him behind bars and keep him there.
You have to participate fiercely, fiercely in what happens next.
I'm Keith Morrison, and this is Murder in the Hollywood Hills, an all-new podcast from Dateline.
Listen to Murder in the Hollywood Hills for free each week or subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or DatelinePremium.com to unlock new episodes 1 week early.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Calera was only a half-hour drive from Birmingham, but the long stretches of road bordered by longleaf pines made it feel much farther away. Within hours of arriving at the Vance property, the promise for a fresh start disappeared.
The first night we actually were there, me and John ended up fighting anyway, so it was kind of crazy, actually, how that worked out.
Devin says John and his dad split a bottle of whiskey and then got into a fight. John was mad that Henry had never been there for him. The land seemed to be a trigger for John. Devin says he took it out on her, that he busted her lip and hit her in the face, leaving her with a knot on the side of her head.
As soon as we got there, none of this is, you know, anything he promised. So here we are again. I felt like I got tricked again, you know. But I was already there, so I had to just deal with it.
John had hit Devin before, but he had been so kind to her the last few weeks that she thought things would be different. It was the cycle of their relationship, and it was confusing. The property itself was not what she expected. Creeping kudzu vines covered everything. John's dad, Henry, lived on the property in a tiny, rundown shack. And since Henry had been in a bad car accident years ago, he wasn't doing any upkeep. The land had taken on a life of its own.
It was just so unbelievable. There were trailers and little shacks and little sheds and stuff. And we walked around and we seen that like everything was pretty much run down. And
Devin says it looked abandoned, almost like a jungle, with grass as tall as she was, like 6 feet tall. There were guard dogs chained up in the yard. Years back, Mama Cat's house had burned down in a gas stove fire, and there was no room for them in Henry's shack.
So, like, we ended up going to Walmart and getting a tent. And we lived in the tent for, like, 2 months.
Eventually, they did move out of that tent and into a dilapidated camper on the property, which they tried to make livable.
We didn't actually have, like, plumbing like inside, so everything was like we had to hook up a hose to the trailer, straight like pioneer style. It was just crazy. It was really like we really roughed it. And I remember like I cooked outside on a hot plate. I washed dishes in a wheelbarrow.
Most of her life, Devin had lived in nice houses, so this was way out of her comfort zone. Still, Devin was accustomed to going with the flow because as a kid in upstate New York, she'd moved around a lot. She spent the longest at her grandparents' house on Saratoga Lake. That was the place that felt like home. She remembers swimming with minnows there long after everyone else went inside. This was nothing like that. But John kept telling her it was gonna work out.
And he was like, don't worry, we're gonna make this place work. And, you know, John had promised that he was gonna build us a house and all that BS. And I fell for it as usual.
Here's something you need to know about Devin. She's incredibly hard on herself, especially for ignoring the red flags, for believing it could be different. But as someone who has experienced abuse myself, I know how hard it is to walk away, especially when you're isolated. Amid all the uncertainty in Alabama for Devin, there was one friendly face, Henry's sister and John's aunt, Sheila, who you met at the top of the episode. Aunt Sheila is the caretaker of the family.
And the property does belong to me. My mom left it to me.
She's organized and keeps herself busy. Every time I call her, she's running off to take care of somebody or something, or to chat with a neighbor.
And I have to go get groceries for my brother. And then I've got to go get tags for my car. So I've got a busy day tomorrow.
Aunt Sheila took to Devin immediately.
What did you think of Devin when you first met her?
Oh, I thought she was a sweetie. Yes, I've always thought that. She was kind of really shy to start with when they first came because, of course, she didn't know any of us.
Devin didn't leave the property much because she didn't have a car. So Aunt Sheila sometimes picked her up to run errands. And eventually, Devin found her footing. She spent her days cooking, watching TV, or tidying up the camper. She sometimes brought Henry warm meals since he wasn't doing well health-wise. Every now and then, Devin and John would go over to Aunt Sheila's for a holiday or family get-together. And when they did, Aunt Sheila noticed something was off.
She finally got to where she was a lot easier with everybody. But to me, it was always kind of strange. He never let her get 3 feet away from him while they were here. I never could understand why he did that, but he was always, and I never really did get to know John very well. I never got to really know him. I really got to know her better than I did him.
Since John had grown up in New York with his mom, Aunt Sheila was absent for most of his life. And now that John was back in Alabama, he was elusive. He drank a lot, and when he wasn't drinking, he was working, always doing odd jobs to make ends meet for him and Devin. When he was home, he sometimes shot guns on the property or rode a tractor around. But he never got too friendly with his dad, Henry, or his Aunt Sheila.
I mean, I would have loved to gotten to know him better.
Yeah.
But, I mean, bless his heart, he had been in trouble so much his whole life.
In New York, John had a lot of pending charges. For assaulting an inmate while at Saratoga County Jail. For allegedly stealing $4,000 from 2 bank accounts. And for that time, he shot a rifle into the air at his sister's place. It's honestly hard to keep track of them all. So John was a fugitive. He was even on the Saratoga Springs Police Department's most wanted list. And he was paranoid in Alabama about getting caught by the law. Anytime he cut his hair, Devin says he would burn the clippings so there would be no trace and the cops couldn't find him. John's paranoia seeped into their relationship, too. In Alabama, Devin was no longer Devin, just D. John had renamed them when they arrived. The few people who got to know them in Alabama knew them as their initials, J and D.
I remember being a little sketched out because we didn't know anything about him. They had, like, no social media presence. We didn't know their last names at all.
That's Desi. At the time, she was married to Ethan, John's best friend in Alabama. Ethan eventually sold them a trailer so they could move out of the dilapidated camper. Desi went over to the property once.
It was strange. I've never really been on any kind of property like that before. And I just thought they had to have really gotten into something bad to be in this situation, but I never really asked any questions about it.
So in the beginning, Desi would see Devin every now and again.
I thought she was really shy at first. She just seemed kind of uncomfortable all the time. Like, I felt like she was just nervous to be. And I think that being in the South here in an interracial relationship is not any way to be comfortable.
Devin says the real reason she was uncomfortable was because of John and the close tabs he kept on her. She was always worried she might say or do the wrong thing or break one of his many rules. But Desi didn't notice that. Instead, she thought Devin felt out of place because they were living in Shelby County, a very white area with a racist history. Just for context, it's the same Shelby County that gutted the Voting Rights Act through a Supreme Court decision in 2013. Devin got there the same year.
I mean, I feel like when we weren't in public, she was much calmer. She would get out of her shell. She would talk to me. She's funny.
Desi would become one of Devin's only friends there, if you could even call it that. Because Desi was really John's friend. Like Aunt Sheila, Desi would take Devin to run errands. But whenever she did, John or Jay arranged them.
I thought her situation was just like mine. Like when they talked about fighting and stuff, I thought maybe he like yelled at her a lot or maybe broke things in the house because that's what I was used to. I didn't think it was like physical fighting. So it was kind of hard for me to really be like, oh, this is a horrible situation because I was in a bad situation too. So it just felt normal. Like now looking back, I'm like, that's not normal at all. But I was 19.
Yeah, she was 19, but there was also a culture of abuse in the area. It was common and people lived with it. Summer turned to fall. Devin said she and John had good days, bad days, and very bad days. John's main job was fixing cell phones out of a gas station. When he got home in the evenings, he and Devin drank together. It always started off fun, but if John didn't make money that day, Devin said it was like a switch flipped, and he got angry.
9 times out of 10, the fights that we had, there was alcohol involved, and it's horrible, but that's what, like, that's really what was always the problem with us, you know, him drinking, and his drinking was just ridiculous, regardless of it.
They both had a drinking problem, and she says John took advantage of that. She says it seemed like he always wanted her to be as drunk or more than he was. One night, they got into a fight over something small that had happened back in New York, and she says John got furious.
Ended up getting, like, slapped really hard, and he had kept hitting me, and he had knocked out my front tooth. It was like a pop, like it literally sounded like a balloon popping like inside my mouth. And I remember just like all of a sudden just like all in my mouth, and I'm like, oh my god, like you knocked out my tooth, and he didn't believe me at first, and then when I opened my mouth, I saw all the blood.
I've seen the photos. Devin's front tooth was gone. After that happened, she says she felt like a failure because she had ended up in this situation. That there must be something wrong with her. With everything she'd endured, she just wanted to go home, but she was too ashamed.
After all the times that he hit me, and me just not wanting to go back because, you know, I had a black eye or I had a bruise, and I just didn't want my family to see me that way, see me so broken. And it just, you know, I just couldn't deal with that.
Devin did consider leaving him that first year in Alabama. She says when she told John she wanted to leave, he was livid and they had a horrible fight, that he slapped her and threw her around the trailer. So she stayed, afraid of what would happen if she left. And Devin says John started to keep a closer watch on her, telling her she couldn't leave the trailer without him being present. He eventually installed surveillance cameras that he kept trained on the property so he could see anyone coming in or out. Including Devin. By Christmas 2013, Devin became unexpectedly pregnant. They had always been careful, and Devin felt that John intentionally did not take precautions so that they'd have a baby, as a way to keep her, a way to tether her to him forever. Devin was worried about bringing a baby into this environment.
I can't leave. I don't have a license. I don't have a car. I don't have friends. I don't have anything.
But when she got pregnant, John stopped hitting her, at least at first. She said she quit drinking alcohol. Things were better. Around this time, Aunt Sheila took Devin to the dentist to finally fix her front tooth, the one she says John had knocked out around 6 months before. John told Devin to tell Aunt Sheila that she fell in the dark.
Actually, what I thought is that she had a tooth and something had happened to it. I mean, an artificial tooth, and then, well, I never asked her, and she never told me. I do wish I had said, well, what happened? But I didn't. I mean, I'm not one to ask a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Everybody's just amazed that I don't even do that with my kids. If it's something and it's their business, I don't ask questions. I raised them the best I could. And I hope that whatever they do, they make the right decisions about things.
There were so many times someone could have intervened, but they didn't recognize the signs or didn't want to get involved. Maybe they only saw what they wanted to see. Because on the outside, John and Devin looked like a couple making it work. Desi says they were building a life together.
They were very passionate with one another. like all of their interactions and things. I mean, he was, I remember this is such a crazy thought, but I remember thinking that I wish that my husband treated me like he did her. And I just can't imagine ever thinking that now. They only had each other. It's like all they had in the world.
Devin's daughter was born in the summer of 2014. Becoming a mother gave her a new purpose. A photo from the day of birth shows Devin in a hospital gown, staring serenely down at her tiny baby. We're not using her name, out of respect for her privacy as a minor. While Devin's love of her daughter sustained her for a little while, it wasn't long before the love with John turned scary again. By 2016, when Devin's daughter was 2 years old, she says the abuse had become a regular occurrence, and it seemed to be escalating. She says it was physical, sexual, and emotional. Devin was sinking into despair. She could hardly sleep anymore, only 3 hours a night. About once a week, she'd have a nightmare about the abuse she faced. Devin was barely leaving the house, and when she did go places with John, she says it was miserable.
I was always so nervous because he would be so like, what are you looking at? What are you looking at? Why are you standing next to me like that? Why are you in the aisle? Would you flirt with that dude? Would you be talking to him? And it's like, oh my gosh, it made me so uncomfortable. Like, it was just, he was so, I don't know, it was like he nitpicked everything I did when I would go out with him, that I didn't even care if he went anywhere without me.
Instead, Devin mostly stayed at home. Her TV and phone were her windows to the outside world. She used the phone to communicate with John and make doctor's appointments for their daughter. But she says John monitored her calls and texts, and she wasn't allowed to contact anyone from back home. That when she tried to call 911, John got violent.
I tried to call the cops on him several times, and I got hit every time, and then he started turning off my phone and hiding it from me while we fought, so I didn't have my phone because he didn't want me to call the cops. So it's not like, you know, I never tried before. It was just something that I never tried again.
A few times she went against John and called her family. She says John found out and changed her number so no one could reach her. Devin tried to stand up to John, but there were a lot of things she says she never tried again because she was terrified of the repercussions of what John would do to her. In 2017, she says she only left the house a total of 4 times. She became a shell of herself. From all my reporting, it's clear she did not leave the relationship because, like many domestic abuse survivors, she could not leave. Devin was under John's coercive control, where a perpetrator grooms a victim, creating trust and then fear. Psychologists compare it to a state of siege. Devin was a mental hostage. She felt like she had nowhere to go, no one to lean on, and no control over her own life.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
As I've gotten to know Devin, I've spoken to dozens of other women behind bars who defended themselves against their abusers and have researched hundreds of these kinds of cases. It's common for women to say, like Devin did, that something was different that night, that if they didn't protect themselves, they were going to die. Devin tells me about the night she shot John and how quickly things escalated.
It was like a total transformation. It wasn't John anymore. I don't know who that was. I don't know who that was. He felt like a monster. And he was choking me. And I remember I was like, I would black out. And then he would like punch me back awake. And I'm like, I don't know what else to do. I don't know how to stop him or anything. And, you know, I was so scared. I was like, he's going to kill me. He's going to kill me. He's going to kill me.
Devin says John told her he was going to finish what he started. She was sure she was going to die. She says he had gotten out his gun and pistol whipped her, that he had shot up the trailer. Meanwhile, their daughter was asleep in the next room. She had grown accustomed to the loud fighting. Victims of abuse make one calculation all the time. What can I do to stay alive? And so, she says, after hours of John beating her, when he finally went to lie down, she picked up the gun.
After it happened, I was like, oh my God, what have I done? And it was like a moment of shock. And then I realized, like, I had to call that little letter, you know.
911, where is your emergency?
I live in Clara. Me and my boyfriend were just fighting, and I just shot him. You, I think he's dead.
You shot him? What's your name?
I'm Devin Grey, G-R-E-Y.
All right, ma'am. Stay on the line with me, okay? We're going to get clear on the line, okay?
Mm-hmm.
After Devin called 911, the cops arrived. John's family started to get word of what had happened. Around 3 a.m. on December 12th, 2017, Aunt Sheila's phone rang. It was her brother, Henry, John's dad.
And he said, sis, I hate to tell you this time of night, but Dee has shot and killed John. Of course, the police came to tell him. He was asleep.
Shortly after that, they brought Henry down to the police station for questioning. Cops were investigating the crime scene now, and Devin's daughter was in the hands of Child Protective Services. Meanwhile, Aunt Sheila was piecing together what happened.
Did that make you upset with her at all, or you felt like you understood from what she said?
Oh, I understood. Oh, no. I was none of my family. I have daughters and a son, and nobody was upset with her once we found out what the whole thing was. And I'm sure she didn't say anything to me about it because of him being my nephew.
Aunt Sheila says she understood that Devin was defending herself because her mom, Mama Cat, had done the same thing when she killed Sheila's stepdad 40 years prior. Court records show Mama Cat was charged with second-degree murder, but Aunt Sheila says her mom's charges, they didn't stick.
And, I mean, that was about one of the shortest trials I've ever seen in my life. It didn't last long at all.
So they ruled that she did it in self-defense?
Yes, they did. She testified to what happened, and, of course, they wanted some people that knew her to testify, and there were several people that did. In fact, I did. I mean, it was just short and sweet and didn't last long at all.
Mama Cat got off, but it wasn't that easy for Devin.
I'm in Alabama, and I feel like it was racing. The fact that I had, like, used a gun and his back was turned. Like, there was, like, things, if you really fine-tooth combed it, like, that they could say, okay, well, you're guilty and you meant to do this.
Devin claimed self-defense at a Stand Your Ground hearing a year after the shooting. She said she had been severely abused, but the judge denied her claim. In the end, she took a blind plea for manslaughter, in part to avoid a majority white jury at trial. She was sentenced to 15 years in prison. She was just 25 years old. Blind pleas are rare nationally. They happen mostly in the Midwest and the South. They're when a person takes a guilty plea without even knowing what sentence they're going to get, which is pretty shocking if you think about it. Even some of the legal experts I spoke with throughout my reporting didn't know much about blind pleas. But that's par for the course in Devin's life, because as I got to know the details of her case, it was clear. Her story is about the things we choose not to see. It's about what happens when we ignore our trauma for too long, when generations of pain lead to a point of no return. Next time on Blind Plea, we'll get into exactly what happened the night Devin killed John. While Devin claimed self-defense, the investigator presented a very different narrative of that night, a narrative that came from someone else entirely. Alexis Bernstein, the other woman John was dating. She wasn't there the night of the shooting, but she had a lot to say about it.
She was shooting the gun and put holes through the ground and everything. And she said she was either going to shoot herself and blame him, or she was going to kill him. And she kept pulling the gun on him, and he was begging me to come get him, and I didn't.
That's in your feed right now. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse, use a safe computer and contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233. There's more Blind Plea with Lemonada Premium. Subscribers get exclusive access to bonus content, like an interview with John's dad, Henry, and tape from Devin's detective interview the night of the shooting. Subscribe now in Apple Podcasts. Blind Plea is a production of Lemonada Media. I'm your host, Liz Flock. This episode was produced by Kristen Lepore, Shenrika Evans, and Tony Williams. Hannah Boomershine and Rachel Pilgrim are also our producers. Story editing by Martina Abrahams-Ilunga. Mix, music, and sound design by Andrea Kristensdatter, with additional mixing and engineering from Ivan Kurayev. Naomi Barr is our fact checker. Jayla Everett is our production intern. Jackie Danziger is our vice president of narrative content. Executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax, Jessica Cordova-Kramer, Evoke Media, Sabrina Mirage Naim, and myself, Liz Flock. This series was co-created with Evoke Media and presented by Marguerite Casey Foundation. Help others find our show by leaving us a rating and writing a review. Follow me at Liz Flock. And for more stories of women and self-defense, check out my book, The Furies, from Harper Books, available for pre-order now. Find Lemonada at Lemonada Media across all social platforms. And follow Blind Plea wherever you get your podcasts or listen ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership. Thanks so much for listening.
The whole thing is crazy.
It is.
I could write a book.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Elise Myers. I'm a content creator and comedian. You might know me from TikTok. Why am I in your ears right now? Well, that's a great question. I would love to tell you. I have a new podcast called Funny Because It's True. On my show, I'll be interviewing comedians, pop culture icons, and also just people I find really funny. We'll be talking about the awkward moments that keep you awake at night. Because if you don't laugh, you cry, right? Okay, Funny Because It's True. Out now wherever you get your podcasts.